You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News, read by Matt. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Historic Althea Center promotes community spiritual connection as Denver evolves. Childcare enrollment freeze leaves families in the cold. And school libraries could get protection from bans. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Denver Herald-Dispatch, week of February 20th, 2025. Historic Althea Center promotes community spiritual connection as Denver evolves. Accompanying picture is a very beautiful building with Roman-style columns. Caption says, "People walk past the entrance to the Althea Center on January 24th. The center celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2022, continues to expand services in Capitol Hill," by Natalie Kerr. Special to Colorado Community Media. In 1889, Nona Brooks became the very first female minister in Denver. She led her congregation in the Divine Science Church as they wrestled with flagging confidence in the United States government, fears of moral and political corruption, strained race and gender relations, economic inequality, and labor unrest. She guided them to let go of their fear and anger to make space for hope and gratitude to invite more blessings into their lives. If you read some of her old writings, she was dealing with things in the world as a woman. She had death threats, her sister had death threats, so they had to live in the present moment, not in fear. But they lived in the present moment, the Althea Center for Engaged Spiritualities, Reverend Christine Jones said. For more than a century, the Althea Center's leaders and members have drawn on Brooks's teachings about metaphysical spirituality to bring unity, hope, and prosperity to the community. The building at 14th Avenue and William Street was built in 1922, and its 100th anniversary was celebrated in 2022. The center continues to expand its services, mission, and membership while navigating changing technology and attitudes toward religion. In addition to its Sunday service and coffee hour, the Althea Center hosts yoga classes, book clubs, spirituality workshops, gong baths, concerts, an annual metaphysical fair in the spring, and houses the Althea Center. And houses several local nonprofits. The Althea Center was known as the Church of Divine Science until 2014, and the congregation continues to practice and share the teachings of Divine Science, a denomination of the New Thought movement. New Thought draws on teachings from a wide range of philosophical and religious practices, including tenets of unity and oneness, affirmative prayer, and practical spirituality, said the center's board president, Emeritus Rich Kitzman. It differs from traditional religion in its broad inclusivity and non-judgment, and prayer practices that aim to make people more receptive to blessings from a higher power, rather than attempting to beg or bargain for a better life. People walk through those doors into this center, and they go, "Oh my God, this energy is just so welcoming and warm," Kitzman said. "We have some rituals, but we use what are called metaphysical terms, perfect life, perfect love, perfect substance. It's not that we don't talk about God, but we talk about oneness and the mind." Some people hear the words divine science and assume the church is a cult or a brand of Scientology, a religious movement founded by the author L. Ron Hubbard in the 1950s. Kitzman said, "But there is nothing secretive or pressured about divine science. It's a teaching some people connect with, particularly those who are not interested in traditional religion. When you grow up in a church that tells you you're just going to go to hell for eternity, it's like, well, why do I want to go back to that?" Kitzman said. Divine Science aims to support and guide people through the complex challenges of the world. Being able to apply the concepts of spirituality to his day-to-day life was what intrigued Board President Bob Burklaw as a young adult. "We don't just talk about all the airy-fairy stuff, although we talk about it, but if you can't use that to make a change in your life, or for healing, for moving forward, for letting go of old stuff that you don't need anymore, for getting out of victimhood, what's the point?" Burkha said. Divine science struggled to attract practitioners in the late 20th century, but in recent years, centers across the country have experienced a renewed interest and upswing in attendance, Jones said. Leaders at the Althea Center attribute that to people's desire to engage with their spirituality and find meaning, but a hesitance to attend traditional religious services where they might have had negative experiences as a child, or fears of being ostracized because of their race, gender, or sexuality. There's so much in our consciousness about organized religion as being restrictive, fear-based, sin-based, and so a lot of people that might still be searching don't even consider the possibility that they could find a religious center or a church-type center that is not fear-based or sin-based, Burkaw said. Denver is the headquarters of the Divine Science faith, with other major churches in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Orlando, Florida. But it has not always been easy for the Althea Center to keep its doors open. In 2014, participation was at an historic low. The building was in need of repairs, and the Althea Center had to cut some programming. The board made the decision to change its name to revitalize its image and attract new members, Burkaw said. Then the COVID-19 pandemic hit in 2020, and the building closed, moving its services online for more than a year. Between 2020 and 2023, when Jones became minister, the center experienced disorientingly frequent changes in leadership, and even went a year without a minister. There's members that have been here 20 years, so if it wasn't for people that have been here a long time, this place would have been closed, Jones said. They kept it alive. An anniversary fundraising effort in 2022 brought $80,000 to the center, which funded repairs in the central sanctuary, patching ceiling leaks, replacing the carpet, repainting, and installing a new boiler. The Althea Center hopes to host more community events, live performances, and reestablish the youth program to use the historic space to its full potential. They're using online tools like Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, and creating youth leadership roles on the board to engage with younger generations and pass their spiritual practices on, Jones said. We're in Capitol Hill, and Denver's grown big time, and I think we could be a big beacon for that, where everyone feels safe because we celebrate all races and LGBTQ, Jones said. There's no judgment. Accompanying photograph, a woman in a large auditorium, captioned, Reverend Christina Jones admires the Althea Center's sanctuary, which dates back more than 100 years, on January 24th. Photo by Natalie Kerr. Child care enrollment freeze leaves families in the cold. By Susie Glassman. S. Glassman at ColoradoCommunityMedia.com. For thousands of working parents in Colorado, child care is more than a service. It's the key to economic stability. But as counties across the state freeze new enrollments in the Colorado Child Care Assistance Program due to funding shortages, families who rely on this crucial support are left in limbo. We need an additional $70 million just to maintain where we are at with CCCAP, said Heather Triton, president and CEO of Colorado Children's Campaign. And right now, CCCAP only serves 10% of the families that qualify. Across the state, counties including Denver, Arapaho, Douglas, Jefferson, Larimer, and Weld have paused new CCCAP enrollments, citing a budget shortfall fueled by rising program costs and the end of federal pandemic relief funds. We knew this cliff was coming, Triton said. The pandemic relief funding allowed many child care providers to stay open and helped families afford care. But without sustainable investment, we're now seeing the consequences. Why is CCCAP enrollment frozen? CCCAP subsidizes childcare costs for low-income families, allowing parents to work or attend school while their children receive licensed care. However, a combination of expired federal funding, increased provider wages mandated by the federal government, and growing program costs has left counties unable to support new families. In 2023-24, nearly 25,000 children benefited from CCCAP, according to data provided by the Colorado Children's Campaign. But with funding stretched thin, many counties have shut the door on new applicants, To put it simply, the cost of providing care for each child is going up. But our funding has not increased to go along with that, said Tara Noble, Jefferson County Human Services Program Manager. The freeze is devastating for families already struggling with high cost of care, explained Paula Smith, Chief Impact Officer with Clayton Early Learning in Denver. In 2023, the average cost of child care in Colorado was $12,750 per year for infants and toddlers, according to Child Care Aware of America. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommends that families spend no more than 7% of their income on child care. Yet in Colorado, a family earning the median household income of $133,443 would need to spend 30.2% of their earnings to care for two children. The financial strain on single-parent households is even greater. Families trapped in the cycle of poverty. Making childcare affordable to families directly impacts their ability to work and earn a living, Smith said. Without a support system like CCCAP, we risk eroding the economic foundation for the entire state, weakening the workforce and stalling future growth. When families don't have affordable childcare, they can't work, she continued. And when they can't work, they become more reliant on government assistance just to survive. This disruption has a generational impact as well. Research from University of Chicago economics professor James Heckman shows that children in high-quality early learning programs are likelier to succeed in school and have higher lifetime earnings. Childcare isn't just about parents. It's also about giving kids the early learning foundation they need, Smith said. When kids lose access to care, we're widening the achievement gap before they even reach kindergarten. According to data from the Colorado Information Marketplace, the state already faces a shortage of licensed childcare slots, with only enough capacity to serve 65% of children under 5 whose parents are working. With CCCAP enrollment paused, even fewer families will have access to affordable care. If you're an employer and your workers don't have childcare, they can't come to work, Smith said. This isn't just a family issue, it's an economic issue. Is there a solution? We need a long-term funding solution, Smith emphasized. The state has recognized the importance of early childhood education, but we can't make progress if families can't even access care. Tritton echoed that urgency. The state legislature needs to invest more in CCCAP to address the funding shortfall and expand access to the program, as the current status quo isn't good enough, she said, while acknowledging the state's financial situation makes it challenging to find an immediate fix. We have TABOR, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, which makes it even more difficult, so the state legislature can't appropriate funds the way other states might be able to. So as we're looking at it, it's a bit of a puzzle right now in terms of how we address the need. In the meantime, families affected by the freeze are left with few alternatives. This is an issue that impacts all of us, whether we have children or not, Smith said. Without access to affordable child care, we risk weakening the workforce and stalling future economic growth. It's time for policymakers to step up. If we can support families with high-quality child care that's affordable, then we start solving some other problems for that family, Tritton added. We want families to be stable and thriving, and we want children to be in a place where they are being prepared for school. Tritton stressed the importance of prioritizing child care assistance in state discussions. We need to encourage our legislatures to think about this and to invest in child care assistance and recognize that this is a program that helps solve bigger problems for families and helps create stability, she said. If we can't help create stability through child care, then we are helping promote work and school and all of these other things as well. School libraries could get protection from bans. Bill clears state Senate committee by Jenny Brunden, CPR News. Photograph is of many books on bookshelves, captioned New Books at Glennon Heights Elementary Library in Lakewood in 2019. A bill to make it harder to remove books from public school libraries cleared its first Colorado legislative hurdle February 10th. After a three-hour debate, members of the State Education Committee approved the bill that would require schools to have a policy on school library book challenges. The bill stipulates that only parents of legal or legal guardians of children at a school could challenge a book in their child's library and ask for its removal. It protects school librarians from retaliation and requires that a school's challenge policy be transparent and posted for the community. It also limits challenges to a book's place in a library to once every 2 years. It's never been more important to protect the freedom to read, said bill sponsor State Senator Lisa Cutter, a Jefferson County Democrat. Free societies don't ban books. She said the bill would protect school libraries from what's known as ban bombing, where hundreds of requests to ban books bombard school librarians. Book challenges have become more prevalent nationwide. In 2022, Colorado was home to nearly 10% of all book challenges, according to the American Library Association. Challenges have drawn lawsuits. Last August, the Elizabeth School Board voted to remove 19 books from library shelves after board members conducted a review for content such as racism, graphic violence, and sexual content. Many of the books on the list were written by or about people of color or LGBTQ people, such as The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison and The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas. School board members called the books, quote, disgusting or ugly, and said it was their duty to protect children. Dozens of other books are on a, quote, sensitive list, unquote, including a number of religious books, books like To Kill a Mockingbird, Catcher in the Rye, and The Hunger Games, that allows parents to prohibit their children from checking out the books. In December, the ACLU filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of two students and two groups, including NAACP of the Rocky Mountains, arguing that the ban violates federal and state free speech protections. It said the book removals deny authors their right to share their books with students free from viewpoint-based censorship. Passionate testimonials. Dozens of parents and students gave impassioned testimony in support of the bill February 10th. They said that books have opened their minds to new ideas and perspectives and have given them a window into the lives very different from their own. They said books spark imagination and are a way to develop critical thinking skills and empathy. Harip Simi Vartanian, an exchange student from the nation of Georgia, testified for the bill. She explained to legislators that her parents and grandparents grew up in the Soviet Union when books were banned. But when I was growing up, there was no Soviet Union, so my parents, they tried for me to have a choice to read whatever book I want. And I'm thankful to them that they give me a choice and the opportunity to be educated and read about the topics that I want, not someone else, Vartanian said. She said she was confused when she heard about books being banned in the United States. Denise Salas of Reforma, Colorado, said her school library was one of the most meaningful parts of her childhood. Reading about characters, navigating challenges, helped me process my own experiences and gave me the words to articulate them. The more I learned, the more I could help my family. Libraries didn't just make me a better student, they made life better for all of us, Salas said. Liz Wilson, co-founder of the Pro Colorado Education Project, said a small but loud group targeted several books at her daughter's public charter school. Wilson said the turmoil derailed the productivity of the school's board, staff, and parents from focusing on academics. I urge you to pass this bill, because without it, Colorado public schools, students, and communities will remain vulnerable to chaos, intimidation, and censorship. If we fail to act, these attacks will escalate, Wilson said. Aaron Meschke, a Boulder resident opposed to the bill, said no one is trying to ban books. Rather, they are trying to make sure books are aligned with standards protecting children from pornography. The majority of books being challenged graphically portray sex, pedophilia, rape, incest, and other things that have nothing to do with developmentally appropriate interest, education, or enlightenment, Meschke said. Reverend Lori Goebel of Faith Now Fellowship said she believes that other people besides parents should be able to lodge complaints against books. She said books that some parents may find offensive shouldn't be in public school libraries. If a parent or guardian chooses to allow their child to access what another parent would deem inappropriate for their child, that is their choice. And there are other places to access these books without placing these books in a school library and crossing the boundaries placed by other parents for their children, Grobel said. But Meg Reed, a grandmother, challenged opponents' assertions that they want to protect parents' rights to guide their children. What they really want is to dictate what is right for all families, Reed said. While they're completely free to deny their own children access to whatever books they might find offensive, they do not have the right to make those decisions for other parents. Mark Fink, executive director of AnyThink Libraries, supported the provision that would make it illegal to fire, demote, or punish a school library worker for selecting, retaining, or displaying a book before it's been reviewed. Without this protection, school library workers are vulnerable to smear campaigns and personal attacks while they do their jobs, which include fostering creative thinking and providing access to a vast marketplace of ideas, Fink said. Matt Cook, director of public policy and advocacy for the Colorado Association of School Boards, said, most school districts already have policies which meet the requirements of the bill. What happens next? A similar bill died last year in the Colorado Senate Education Committee. This year, with two different Democrats on the committee and some changes to appease the Colorado Association of School Boards, the bill passed on a 5-2 vote. It now goes to the Senate floor for a vote. This story is from CPR News, a nonprofit public broadcaster serving Colorado, used by permission. For more, and to support Colorado Public Radio, visit CPR.org. We move on now to an editorial. If you don't find the home you're looking for, we have the tools to find one that's not on the MLS. Real Estate Today by Jim Smith, Realtor. I took a class recently in which I learned to use a tool for searching public records in the same way that agents can search the MLS, using criteria that even the MLS doesn't have. Now, if you can't find a home for sale that meets your needs, we know how to conduct a search of all homes using those same criteria and reach out to the homeowners to see if they would sell to you. By the way, this tool is only available to agents who are realtors. That is, members of the local and national realtor association. Only about half of Colorado's licensed real estate agents are realtors. Here's how it works, although not always up to date because of homeowners who did not get permits for certain improvements to their homes. The public records do contain extensive information that can be searched using this tool. We can search not only for style, square footage, bedrooms, bathrooms, and lot size, but also for finished or unfinished basements, whether the home is owner-occupied or a rental, and other criteria including deck, swimming pool, accessory dwelling unit, ADU, barn, workshop, corner lot or cul-de-sac, fireplace, and estimated value. The estimated value is not the assessor's valuation, which is often inaccurate and, at any rate, not current. The assessor's valuation is as of June 30th of the previous even-numbered year, 2024. This tool's valuation is based on recent comparable sales from both the MLS and off-MLS transactions. Last, but definitely not least, we can search for homes that were purchased over 5, 10, 15, or 20 years ago. Owners who purchased their home less than 5 years ago are least likely to be interested in selling, so we don't bother. By the way, this same tool can also be used instead of the MLS itself to search MLS listings using those same search criteria above, many of which are not available on MLS searches. Also, we can add any other search criteria that is important to you, not just the ones listed above, using a keyword search. These can include anything, sauna, walk-in, bathtub, or you name it, literally. Another important criterion for any buyer is location. You can specify any area, city, or subdivision, or multiple areas and subdivisions. So let's say hypothetically that you would like us to solicit owners of a 2-story homes with Littleton addresses, but not in Douglas County, that were purchased over 10 years ago. The home must have 3 to 4 bedrooms and 2 or more bathrooms, and it must have a 3-car garage, a finished basement, and a workshop. You will consider homes with a valuation up to $900,000. The house should be no more than 30 years old, and it must be owner-occupied. Working with those criteria, we come up with an Excel spreadsheet which includes the address and name of the owner. Using a separate app, we could add to the spreadsheet the landline and cell numbers of each owner. Using a mail merge program, we could send individually printed letters in individually printed envelopes saying that we have a buyer who is looking for a home like theirs. We could also call the owners or give you the list and let you call them after you've signed the buyer agency agreement. This would require that the home is not listed by another agent, which we can confirm. This tool can also be used to search expired listings without the use of lead generation services, which often provide faulty or out-of-date data and don't verify that the home has not been relisted by another agent. Although the inventory of homes for sale is much greater than it has been, this tool allows us to open up the whole universe of homes, whether for sale or not, which match your specific desires. If this sounds like something you'd like us to play with on your behalf, call me or any of our broker associates listed below, and we'll get to work for you. Next article, have you heard of pig butchering? It's the latest, most dangerous kind of scam. Again, by Jim Smith, Realtor. We all know someone who has been scammed. My own sister lost $15,000 to a scammer. Since starting this column/ad in 2003, I have warned readers at least 10 times about rental scams, and a few months ago I described how a scammer listed a parcel of land he didn't own with us. And we only found out that was the case when the title company sent a FedEx letter to the owner to record of record to verify the transaction before it was, quote, sold to a neighbor. In my April 6th, 2017 column, I wrote about a golden man whom I met because he wanted to buy a $1 million property once his inheritance arrived from his Nigerian scammer. I couldn't convince him he was being scammed, and he died penniless and homeless, still clinging to his dream. You and those you know probably have your own stories about scammers. Recently, I came across an 8-part podcast by Economist Podcasts called, quote, Scam Inc. I strongly recommend listening to it. It costs a couple dollars per month to subscribe to all Economist Podcasts, but this one is worth every penny by itself, and you can cancel after you've listened to it. Pig butchering, I learned, is a Chinese term. Pork is their most precious meat, and the scam entails finding the, quote, pig, or you, building a pigsty, messaging by text or on WhatsApp, feeding it, building rapport, eventually guiding the person to invest in crypto, rewarding it, showing phony paper returns on the crypto investment, and ultimately butchering it, taking all of your funds before you realize the investment was a hoax. Pig butchering takes a lot of time. It sounds a lot like what Bernie Madoff did, doesn't it? But this is done by English-speaking Southeast Asians, mostly in Myanmar, who find a reason never to betray themselves by speaking to you on the phone, where you would recognize they're not who they pretend to be. Sometimes, but not always, these are romance scams, where the scammer gradually convinces you of their love and provides pictures which are stolen off the internet. The first example in the Scam Inc. podcast, however, was of a Kansas bank president who was conned into investing his bank's reserves into crypto by a non-romance scammer, who simply appealed to the banker's desire for self-enrichment. He lost $42 million of the bank's money. The bank was ultimately forced out of business. No one knew the president could believe what he had done. Correction, no one who knew the president could believe what he had done. Here's a bit of advice that I learned. Take the picture you receive from a possible scammer and go to the search field of google.com. At the right of that field, next to the microphone icon, is an icon which says search by image. When you float your cursor over it, click on that icon, drag or upload a picture, and it will instantly show you everywhere that picture appears. I uploaded my own picture, and fortunately it only showed my own websites. Again, please listen to the Scam Inc. podcast. You will learn a lot you need to know. Inset Box. Is your home wildfire ready? My January 13th, 2025 column described ways in which homes could be made fire resistant. If you read that article on our blog, realestatetoday.substack.com, you saw multiple links to articles and reports from Colorado to California on how to harden your home against wildfire. Since then, I became aware of a website, rotarywildfireready.com, created by the Rotary Clubs of Evergreen, Conifer, Boulder, and Mountain Foothills, in cooperation with fire departments, community leaders, and Fire Adapted Colorado. You'll be impressed, as I was, by how comprehensive this website is, providing a wide array of advice and resources not just on hardening your home, but on preparing for the eventuality of an evacuation order. Next, Inset Box. Environmental Film Festival. The Colorado Environmental Film Festival runs this weekend, February 21 through 23, at the Green Center, 924 16th Street, Golden, on the campus of the Colorado School of Mines. I wrote about the festival in last week's column. You can study the three-day schedule at ceff2025.eventive.org/schedule, and buy tickets ceff.net/tickets. If you go, look for our booth in the Eco Expo, where you can browse the display of current solar-powered homes, and let us know if you'd like to see any of them. This editorial is accompanied by real estate listings. The first one, just listed, two-bedroom townhome in Lakewood. Don't miss this remodeled two-bedroom, one-bathroom townhome, 3355 South Flower, number 59, in the quiet Jefferson Green subdivision northeast of Highway 285 and Kipling Street. Features include the new luxury wood-look vinyl flooring throughout the first floor, new lighting fixtures, new stainless steel sink and range. The fully tiled bathroom has a new vanity and lighting. The bedrooms have new carpeting, ceiling fans, and the primary bedroom has a walk-in closet. There are newer windows throughout. The LG washer and dryer are included. Also included is one space in the two-car shared garage with a storage area included. A second designated parking spot is in the parking lot. This home is move-in ready. Listing agent David DeLugash has created a narrated video walkthrough, which you will find along with lots of magazine quality pictures at www.grelistings.com. He'll be holding it open this Saturday, February 22nd from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. or call him at 303-908-4835 to arrange a private showing. Next listing, just listed, three-bedroom, three-bath patio home in Lakewood. Meticulously maintained with many quality upgrades, this turnkey patio home at 2601 South Kipling Court is ready for new owners. Located in a private gated community, it is two blocks from Bear Creek Park. The large main level has vaulted ceilings and south-facing windows that provide plenty of natural light. The spacious main floor is 1,911 square feet, and features an updated kitchen with quartz countertops, gas range, and stainless steel appliances. The living room is open to the kitchen and dining areas and has a stacked rock gas fireplace. The large primary bedroom with a five-piece bath has a sliding door to access the outdoor patio. The main level also includes a second bedroom, a three-quarter guest bathroom, and an office space. Quality wood flooring, lighting, handrails, and paint add to the cozy ambiance. There is a large main floor laundry with built-in cabinets and utility sink, washer and dryer included. The basement is professionally finished with 9-foot ceilings, family room, bar, pool room, with custom pool table included. A third bedroom and third bath, and a large 350 square foot storage area. There is a newer furnace and AC as well as new garage door and opener. The seller is open to selling any furniture in the home. Find additional photos and view a narrated video walkthrough at www.grelistings.com. To arrange a showing, call listing agent Jim Swanson on his cell phone anytime, 303-929-2929. List price $785,000. List price on the previous listing, actually $300,000. I believe I forgot to mention that before. Inset ads on this page, Golden Real Estate's Broker Associates, Dave DeLugash, Chuck Brown, Kathy Jonk, Chris Schultz, Greg Kraft, Jim Swanson. And Golden Real Estate, Jim Smith. Broker owner, 303-525-1851, jim@goldenrealestate.com. Hometown service delivered with integrity, promoting and modeling environmental responsibility. Advertisement on the next page. Common Spirit Hospital's Community Benefit Forums, April 7th through May 7th. We invite you to attend our hospital community benefit forums to learn about our 2024 community benefit investments and community health needs assessments. Our leaders also will share how we advance care by participating in the hospital transformation program. Additionally, one of our health equity and advancement fund awardees will share information about their organization and how their funded initiative is improving community health in our region. Your attendance and participation will help us strengthen our multi-sector collaboration and our commitment to building healthier communities. Language assistance service will be provided if you speak a language other than English, including ASL. Please visit mountain.commonspirit.org/forums or scan the QR code to register for the event. House cats with bird flu could pose risk. Photograph of a woman scratching the chin of a cat. Subtitle is, cats are at high risk of transmitting bird flu to humans because owners snuggle with and sleep with cats. When we're not looking, cats drink from our water glasses and walk on kitchen counters. Some pets died after drinking raw milk, Midnight Prowls, by Sarah Bowden. KFF Health News. More than 80 domestic cats, among many other types of mammals, have been confirmed to have had bird flu since 2022. Generally, barn cats that lived on dairy farms, as well as feral cats and pets that spend time outdoors, and likely caught it by hunting diseased rodents or wild birds. Now, a small but growing number of house cats have gotten sick from H5N1, the bird flu strain driving the current U.S. outbreak, after eating raw food or drinking unpasteurized milk. Some of those cats died. The strain of bird flu currently circulating has not adapted to efficiently spread among people, and there have been no known cases of cat-to-human transmission during the current outbreak of H5N1. Still, there's always been the risk that cats, which are arguably only semi-domesticated, could bring home a disease from a midnight prowl. Companion animals, and especially cats, are 100% a public health risk in terms of the risk of zoonotic transmission to people, said virologist Angela Rasmussen, who studies disease progression in emerging viruses at the University of Saskatchewan's Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization. This is because we snuggle with and sleep in bed with our cats. When we're not looking, cats drink from our water glasses and walk on kitchen counters. So, cat owners should be aware of the ongoing spread of bird flu. By reducing the risk to your cats, you reduce the risk to yourself, Rasmussen said. Rasmussen doesn't think pet owners should be afraid of their cats, or should be afraid their cats will give them bird flu, but said taking precautions is good for pets and for public health. Signs of bird flu in cats include runny nose and discharge around the eyes, explained Michael Q. Bailey, president-elect of the American Veterinary Medical Association. H5N1 also causes neurological problems like dizziness and seizures, which are symptoms of rabies too. Rabies is almost always fatal, and it poses a threat to human health, so any animal suspected of having the viral disease must be euthanized. Bailey encourages people to ensure pets are up to date on their vaccinations. Veterinarian Jane Sykes, who specializes in infectious diseases in cats and dogs at the University of California, Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, said people should not assume it's bird flu if their cat is sick, even if their animal spends time outdoors or eats raw diet. Upper respiratory illnesses are common in cats, while H5N1 is, quote, still pretty rare, unquote. Sykes gives her indoor cat Freckles regular kibble exclusively. She told NPR and KFF Health News, she has no concerns about Freckles getting H5N1 because the heating process of making dry or canned pet food kills viruses. More cases in cats, more risk to humans. Some people feed their pets raw meat or unpasteurized milk because they think it's a more nutritious or natural diet. The American Veterinary Medical Association's website discourages this due to foodborne pathogens like Salmonella and Listeria, and now the highly pathogenic H5N1. State and local public health agencies, including those in Los Angeles County and Washington State, have issued similar warnings against raw food diets for pets. Concerns for human health are partly why the FDA announced last month it is now requiring cat and dog food companies to update their safety plans to protect against bird flu. Veterinarians also warn pet owners not to allow cats unsupervised time outside, as there's the risk of them getting H5N1 by interacting with other animals that might carry the disease. This is a very scary virus, given that it can infect so many different host species, said Bruce Kornreich, director of Cornell University's Feline Health Center. At least one instance of a cat infecting a person with bird flu occurred in 2016, as NPR reported, a veterinarian in New York City caught the virus after having close contact with infected cats. The vet experienced mild symptoms and quickly recovered. There isn't a lot of research on transmission of bird flu from companion animals, like cats or dogs, to humans, though Rasmussen agreed it's definitely a concern. The more infections you have in animals, the more your luck is potentially going to run out. Most people who have caught H5N1 are agricultural workers who had direct contact with infected poultry or cattle. Of at least 67 confirmed human cases of H5N1 in the U.S., there's been one fatality in an immunocompromised person who had contact with birds. Chances for mutation. Part of the concern with H5N1 outbreak is that bird flu viruses change. Just a few mutations could make this strain adept at spreading between people. And the more people who catch H5N1, the more likely it will adapt to be more efficient, said Suresh Kuchipudi, a virologist at the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, where he researches zoonotic diseases. Kuchipudi has studied H5N1 in cats. Another concern is something called reassortment. If an animal or person is infected with two viruses at once, the viruses can trade genetic material, creating something new. This is common in influenza, so virologists are on the lookout for a case in which the bird flu reassorts to make a virus that's far more contagious and potentially more virulent. Kuchipudi said that reassortments are relatively rare events, but the outcome is completely unpredictable. Sometimes the results are benign, though it was likely a reassortment that involved an avian virus that led to the 1918 flu pandemic, which killed an estimated 50 million people. In the centuries since, virologists have established a global surveillance network to monitor influenza viruses. Scientists say continued investment in this network is key to preparing for and hopefully preventing another pandemic. Rasmussen and Kuchipudi cautioned there isn't enough research to know for sure how much virus cats shed, or even how they shed the virus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was poised to release a new study about H5N1 in cats, but that was delayed when the Trump administration paused the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report. That investigation revealed through emails obtained by KFF Health News in a public records request, found that house cats likely got bird flu from dairy workers. Scientists and public health agencies should question previously held assumptions about bird flu, Kuchipudi urged. He noted that 20 years ago, nobody would have predicted that bird flu would infect dairy cattle the way it is now. Dogs seem to fare better. The FDA says other domesticated animals, including dogs, can get bird flu infections. There are no confirmed cases of H5N1 among dogs in the U.S., though in other countries they have died from the virus. There's very little people can do about the H5N1 circulating in wild birds. As Rasmussen explained, it's flying around the skies. It's migrating north and south with the seasons. But she said there's a lot of people can do to keep the virus out of their homes. That includes limiting a pet's exposure to H5N1 by not feeding them raw food or unpasteurized milk, and trying to keep them from interacting with animals like rodents and wild birds that could be infected with the virus. KFF Health News is a national newsroom that produces in-depth journalism about health issues and is one of the core operating programs at KFF, an independent source of health policy research, polling, and journalism. State gets behind bid for Stanley Hotel Film Center. Economic Development Commission approves $1 million grant to boost efforts by Sarah Mulholland, CPR News. Photograph accompanying this article is of the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park. Subtitle is, "The grant and a $400 million bond package will be used to transform the hotel, best known as the inspiration for Stephen King's The Shining, into the Stanley Film Center." Colorado is upping its stake in developing Estes Park's Stanley Hotel into a tourist destination for horror film buffs. The state's Economic Development Commission approved a $1 million grant from its Strategic Fund for the Colorado Education and Cultural Facilities Authority, or CEFCA, the Colorado agency taking over the property. The cash will go toward greasing the wheels for the CECFA to issue $400 million in bonds. The proceeds will be used to transform the iconic hotel, best known as the inspiration for Stephen King's The Shining, into the Stanley Film Center. The project, billed as a horror-themed museum and event space, has been in the works for a decade. It was approved for state funding in 2015 under Colorado's Regional Tourism Act, a state program created in 2009 to attract out-of-state visitors following the recession brought on by the housing crisis. To qualify for funding, projects had to show they were likely to substantially increase visitation to the state. The film center has since run into numerous delays and struggled to raise cash. Owner John Cullen, whose Grand Heritage Hotel Group bought the property out of bankruptcy in 1990s, announced a deal to sell the property to an Arizona nonprofit in 2023, but that deal fell through. Now the CEFCA is stepping in. "We've come a long way in a really difficult market," Cullen said during a meeting Tuesday with the state's Economic Development Commission. On top of the $1 million grant to be paid out after the bonds are sold, the commission approved the early release of some taxpayer funds already allocated to the film center from the Regional Tourism Act. The project was awarded up to $46.3 million from state sales tax to be paid out over 30 years. The commission also extended the deadline for completion to December 31st, 2028. "Since there have been some challenges and delays in getting the financing done, we want to allow the project adequate time to be completed," Jeff Kraft, Deputy Director of Colorado's Office of Economic Development and International Trade, said during the meeting. The CEFCA is a state bonding authority that issues low-cost debt to fund things like schools and museums. It was created by Colorado's state legislature in 1981. This is the first time it's taken ownership of a property. Despite its challenges, the Stanley Film Center has had some wins. Horror movie studio Blumhouse has signed on to curate the exhibit space. Last year, the Sundance Film Festival announced a partnership with the Stanley to host its director's lab. Colorado is currently courting Sundance to become the new home of its signature film festival. This story is from CPR News, a nonprofit public broadcaster serving Colorado, used by permission. For more and to support Colorado Public Radio, visit cpr.org. Advertisement on this page Reverse mortgages made easy. Call me to schedule your free confidential in-home review of this unique product. Mike Bruha, Reverse Mortgage Specialist, cell 720-435-0653. Mike at rmofco.com. Catch this Conifer family on new survival TV show Extracted. Photograph of a man, woman, and young boy, sorry, teenage boy, Conifer couple Sarah Thomas left and Brian Willis middle, along with Ryan's brother Sean Willis right, are on a new survival TV show called Extracted on Hulu by John Renfro, J. Renfro at ColoradoCommunityMedia.com. How long could you watch your family struggle to survive in the wild before pulling the plug? Well, if there were $250,000 on the line? That's the premise of the new show Extracted, which premiered on Fox on February 10th, with new episodes being released weekly. Conifer resident Sarah Thomas will watch her husband Ryan Willis battle extremely grueling conditions, perilous terrain, and the threat of predators in the Canadian wilderness. From the stressful safety of the family HQ, Thomas and other contestants' relatives will watch with bated breath to determine if and when to remove their loved ones from the situation. Family alliances can be formed to allocate which contestant or contestants get helpful supplies and who is left to their own devices. The last remaining contestant in the wild will win $250,000. Someone from casting reached out to me and kind of pitched the idea of the show, Thomas said. And so basically all we knew was that we needed a family group of three, and one of us had to go into the wilderness, and then the other two would be left somewhere else to kind of facilitate supplies for the person in the wilderness. I pitched it to Ryan after I heard about it, and he was like, heck yeah, that sounds amazing. The Conifer family, one of 12 selected to be on the show, didn't have to draw straws. Willis was thrilled to be the one taking on the elements. Growing up outdoorsy in Colorado, Willis took to the competition with a hungry excitement to test himself and his limits. He explained how he'd always loved survival shows like Alone or Survivor Man, but admitted he didn't carry any polished survival skills himself. Yeah, sweet. I'll go into the woods, Willis said on his reaction when Thomas pitched it to him. I went out one night and camped without anything to prepare for it, but other than that, no other training. Other than just general camping, you know, in Colorado, stuff like that. But the point they wanted was that we didn't actually know how to do anything. Thomas said despite the contestants having a varying array of skills, it was still a group of 12 amateur survivalists. Some had never slept a day outside before, while others, like Willis, grew up recreationally roughing it in the Rocky Mountains. But things got real pretty quickly when Willis was picked up in a helicopter, only allowed to bring the clothes on his back, a t-shirt, light hoodie, hat, socks, and boots. He was given a canteen with 12 ounces of water and some camera equipment. That was it, until the first supply drop hit. That's where Thomas and Willis's brother Sean came in. We kind of expected that in the first day to be able to do a supply drop, but he literally went over 24 hours without any tools, any extra water, nothing for over a day, Thomas said. He was not fazed. He was just hanging out, building a shelter, you know, piling sticks and stuff. He was getting ready for the supply drop, but he had a good attitude about it. Willis took it in stride. But at the HQ, Thomas said she was starting to worry. We had no idea what to expect from the HQ experience, and so it was super stressful to sit there that whole first day and just watch and not be able to do a single thing to help him, she said. He would come on camera and be like, yep, I could really use a fire, or it'd be really nice to have some tools, and we were just kind of stuck without being able to do anything for so long. Ryan was having the best time of his life, and we were stressed in HQ, wondering when we were going to be able to help him. Thomas said the first few days were tame, but tensions flared as families had to decide who got what supplies. Well, there was just this stress of, did you pick correct, or are people going to be mad at us because we got Ryan this amazing supply box, and other people didn't do as good under pressure and didn't get as many supplies as we were able to send to Ryan, Thomas said. Catch Extracted weekly on Fox and streaming on Hulu to watch Willis battle the elements as his family cheers him on and helps straighten his course. Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News. That's all the time we have.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.